You're listening to Choose FI Radio. The blueprint for financial independence lives here. If you're looking to unlock the secrets to financial independence and early retirement, you're in the right place. Stay tuned and join a community of like-minded people who are getting off the hamster wheel and taking control of their lives in the pursuit of financial independence. Choose FI, your home for financial independence online.
And welcome to the Choose FI Radio podcast. This is the episode that we've been talking to you about, letting you know that it was coming for the last couple of weeks. We're bringing Dominic Cortuccio back on the show today. We featured him in episode 31 in one of our most highly regarded episodes, Design Your Future. I'm just going to be honest with you. You should not start with this episode. If you have not yet listened to Design Your Future, go back to episode 31. You need to start there. But once you have gone through that entire episode and wrapped your head around those concepts, you're ready for this. Today, we are going to be talking about drift. And frankly, I'm just going to let you guys know that within the next year or two, this is simply going to be a TED Talk. I don't know that because Dominic has told me this, but this is one of the most important and powerful topics that I'm not seeing enough people talk about. And I can see the writing on the wall. This is going to happen. But I'm really excited that you get to hear it first. And to help me with this, I have my co-host Brad here with me today. How you doing, buddy?
Hey, Jonathan, I'm doing really well. It's always a pleasure to speak with Dominic, to have him on the podcast. It's just such a treasure for our entire community. So this should be an interesting conversation, both about drift and how that actually impacts our lives with technology and other ways that we spend our time. And I think this is really important. You know, you and I look at financial independence as a life optimization strategy. So it's not just the nuts and bolts of saving an extra dollar. It's about living a better life and a more intentional life. And I think Dom is really the perfect person to help us explore that. So with that, Dom, welcome back to the show.
Brad, Jonathan, it's so awesome to be back. And I know I've said this before, but you guys rocked on your NBC television news segment. And I cannot praise you enough for the work that you're doing in taking something like this and making it so accessible to many. I think you guys are putting a dent in the world, and I can't wait to see the impact in the next year, 3 years, 5 years.
Well, Dominic, I've gotten a chance to witness you doing a keynote event, and you're phenomenal. So that's high praise and so appreciated. And the only thing I can say is that when we were on that NBC station, we didn't have to think of what we were going to say. We weren't scrambling. We've been living this out, these conversations out over the last 2 years. So it was just the natural response at that particular point in time. I love this information. And as soon as I open my mouth, it's hard for me to not talk about it. That's how much I enjoy simply the conversation.
It's so obvious to see, fellas. There's just, you guys are dripping with authenticity and approachability. And that's why you guys continue to grow at the clip that you do. So it's awesome to see.
So I think the place to start with this episode is basically to set the parameters, which is that Brad has looked to you as a mentor for the last several years, and having you on the show was a direct result of those conversations. And a lot of the stuff that we talked about back in episode 31 was talking about this idea of designing your future, something that I think all of us hopefully at some point will be fortunate enough to start considering. And we knew we wanted to come back to this conversation, have you back on, and go a little bit deeper into this concept of drift. I think for our audience, although we touched on it in episode 31, I'd love for you to kind of reintroduce it. What is drift, and why is this something that all of us should be concerned about?
Okay. Drift is the enemy of intentionality. And so in the context of the FI community, you are living an intentional life around how do you spend less, save more, invest the difference, and then live a life of freedom within a period of whatever the horizon is that you've specified in your life. That is a very intentional way of living your life. Drift is the opposite of that. It's when you start to just move away from those commitments that you've made to yourself, and drift is constantly pulling at us to keep us off track. I learned about this concept from someone that I consider to be my mentor, even though he's been dead for decades. And the gentleman who introduced this concept to me is the author of Think and Grow Rich fame, Napoleon Hill. There have only been 15 books that have ever sold over 50 million copies in the history. These are non-religious texts. And most of those books are like Harry Potter type books or The Hobbit. The only business book that has ever sold over 50 million copies is Napoleon Hill's Think and Grow Rich. So who's Napoleon Hill? Napoleon Hill grew up during the Great Depression era, and he had a mentor by the name of Andrew Carnegie, right? So the Carnegie fame. And Carnegie said, Napoleon, if you want to learn about what makes the most successful people in the world successful, then you have to interview the most successful people of the world, interview 500 of them and mine their secrets. And so that's exactly what he did. He went out and interviewed the Henry Fords, the Roosevelts, the Rockefellers, and distilled their secrets and wrote the book, Think and Grow Rich, which became this Bible for how to attract riches and abundance into your life. But what I was most interested in was the second part of the challenge that Andrew Carnegie gave to him, which was to say, and if you really want to understand the human experience, then you need to go out and interview 10 times as many people who, on their deathbed, recognize and acknowledge that they left chips on the table, that they did not live a life of intentionality and are willing to be honest with you about what they did and didn't do that put them in that place where they ended up on their deathbed in a place of regret. So the consummate overachiever Napoleon Hill went out and interviewed not just 10 times as many, he interviewed, I think it was like 50 times as many. He ended up interviewing 25,000 people over a 2 to 3 decade period who felt like they left chips on the table. He mined their stories, and he ended up writing a book called Outwitting the Devil, which is the bookend to Think and Grow Rich. It's this cautionary tale about what happens if you live in a life of drift. The book was deemed so controversial because he takes some shots at educational systems and religious institutions, and his family buried that book for, I think it was like 7 or 8 decades. It only became available in 2011. I bought the book on a recommendation from a mentor. It was sitting on my nightstand collecting dust. And when Hurricane Sandy hit here in New York City, power went out, no running water, no cell service, no electricity for 5 days. All I had was a flashlight and that book. I dove into it, and I ended up reading something that sunk into my core that, with no other distractions available, it just like reverberated inside of me in a way that changed my life forever. The passage that I read was written from the standpoint of the devil speaking. And the devil in this book is basically a collection of the 25,000 people's state of drift. And what the devil said was, the way that I get people off track is I enter the minds of people through habit. And in habit, I establish this practice of drift. And when I get a person to drift, I can lead him straight towards the gates of hell. And what he's talking about there, about establishing this habit of drift, is that we think on this conscious level that we are making decisions consciously, actively, proactively, when in fact, we are actually just running on autopilot. We're letting our habits and patterns that we've accumulated over the course of our lives lead us through this hypnotic rhythm of life. And it's only when an outside force thrusts itself upon us, like an unexpected illness, losing a loved one, maybe an unexpected pregnancy, losing a job, an investment plummeting, these terrible circumstances, it's typically a crappy circumstance, that we actually truly wake up from our slumber, our drift, and we start to ask these more existential foundational questions about what am I doing, what am I committed to, and am I connected to purpose? And what I see as a coach and a leader and a speaker is that I see so many people who go through these awful situations that can become the most transformational moments of their life. You know, Brad, I know some specific instances where you were, you know, put to the test with your business that became a launching pad for what you are doing right now with ChooseFI. Jonathan, I can guarantee you, you've had like a really difficult circumstance that has caused you to question, and it makes you the man that you are today. And your listeners are probably feeling the same way. So those moments can be beautiful and profound, but here's the problem. If the only moments that catalyze true change or introspection in our life are coming from outside forces thrusting itself upon us, then how in command of your life are you really? I'm most interested in building a muscle around how can you recognize when you are in drift yourself, not waiting for an outside force, to be able to navigate that internally and then to disrupt yourself so you can truly and constantly live a state of intentionality.
Dom, what you just said there, how in command of your life are you really? That just hit home for me. So I think you've said previously that something like 95% of thoughts, feelings, behaviors are all unconscious. They're all just operating on this habit loop in essence. And you're talking about this outwitting the devil and habits being, I guess, the devil's plaything in this regard towards leading people towards drift. Have you ever really dove into good and bad habits? Because not all habits by definition are bad in this regard. But if you actually dove into one of your friends or clients or even yourself, have you ever looked at your own habits and said like, okay, most of these are good, but here are the 5 or 10 that I need to cut out. Like, how do you actually dive deep into your own habits and take that step back?
This is such a robust question. So to go back to the statistic that you shared, neuroscience has shown, and there's some, you know, there's a range here that neuroscientists will say that somewhere between 87 to 97% of our thoughts and feelings and behaviors fall below our conscious detection. So I like to say that 95% of our thoughts, feelings, and behaviors fall below our conscious detection. Only 5% of what we think, feel, and do, we're actually able to consciously detect. And so in the 5%, this is where your willpower and discipline reside. This is where like you make a conscious choice. This is where like the evolved part of your brain, the conscious part of your brain makes decisions, but it's also the part that depletes very quickly. The 95%, this is the accumulation of a lifetime of belief systems and habits and patterns that often aren't consciously designed. And if you think about the way that our bodies are structured, our brain is only responsible for 2% of our body mass, our body weight, so 2%, but it requires about 20 to 25% of our energy. So our brain is, it's only like 2% of our body mass, but it takes about 20 to 25% of our energy. So we are naturally inclined, our brains are naturally inclined to find shortcuts and systems that allow us to operate much more efficiently. Could you imagine if every time that you woke up and got out of bed in the morning that you had to consciously think about, I have to put my left foot down on the floor, right foot down on the floor, I have to pick up my toothbrush, it would drain you. You wouldn't get past the first half hour of your day. So we create these shortcuts that allow us to actually operate. And Brad, to get to your question specifically, most of us that end up in a place where we're functioning have developed habits and patterns that serve us. And if we're not evaluating those habits and patterns on a regular basis, then we can end up in a state of drift where what was once serving us is no longer serving us. Let me give you a specific example. What I find with a lot of people who are high performers, because I end up working with a lot of them in the professional space, is the Marshall Goldsmith quote of what got you here won't get you there. So for example, one of the things that I find with high performers is this constant theme of they got there because they worked harder than everyone else. And they built this muscle of being first man, first woman in the office, last man, last woman out of the office. And that is a strength, that is a habit, that you, a skill set that you build up over the course of a lifetime that can serve you very well. And then you realize, most people don't realize that that is not a scalable model. There are only so many hours in the day. You only have a certain amount of energy that you can capitalize on. And yet when you reach this threshold of now, you have to go to the next level. Like you want to double your sales goal, or you want to double your free time, or you want to double whatever it is. You can't do that by continuing to work more. You're actually running yourself into the ground. But most people don't stop and inspect that belief system around, oh, the only way I can achieve more is by working more. They just don't even question. It's not even on their radar. And so I find people constantly pushing into the state of burnout where they're not just, they're taking on everything at work, everything at home, everything in their friends' lives come to them because they're that consummate high achiever. And without stepping back and looking at, is this system outdated? Am I running on iOS 3 when it's like iOS 11 time? Then you are draining your battery in a way that's no longer serving you.
What does it look like to hit a reset button on that?
It can be painful at first, Jonathan. it can be extraordinarily liberating. Let me give you an example of my life. So a specific example of my life. When I was 25 years old, I was this like fresh-faced kid at Prudential Retirement. So we sold 401k plans and pension plans to large organizations. I was this super lowly sales support person that supported like our top salesperson. And I looked at the salespeople and I was like, these guys call their own shots. They make a ton of money. They have expense accounts. Like, I want to do what those guys do. They seemed like they walked on water. And there was this one day where the national head of sales came bursting into a conference room that I was sitting in. He's like, Dominic, do you want to be a salesperson? And I'm like, yeah, George, I do. And he goes, great. You got this channel, M&T Bank. Go up to upstate New York and sell through M&T Bank. I'm like, okay, great. And he walks away. I didn't really realize what I had agreed to. But when you're young and hungry, you just say yes to an opportunity, you figure it out later. What ended up happening was I found out that I had inherited the single coldest sales channel at Prudential Retirement. We had an existing relationship with them that needed to be managed, but from a new business standpoint, it was cold. And so I went up there as this like baby-faced kid. When I met the decision makers that were up there, Jim and Ann, they were in their 50s. They looked at me and they laughed at how much of a child that I appeared to be. And they were like a little bit insulted that I was the new ambassador for Prudential. What I had to do with them was to say, guys, to be honest, I don't have experience. I know I look young. What I lack in industry knowledge, I will more than make up for in hustle. And if you just give me a shot, I will be the most responsive person that you've ever met. And I will do that for all of the advisors that like you want me to support. God bless them. They took me up on that offer and they gave me that chance. And the short of the story is over the next 18 months, I turned that into one of the most vibrant selling channels in all of Prudential Retirement. The salesperson who gave up the channel, who had an entire territory of like Massachusetts and upstate New York, I outsold him in his entire territory with just that channel alone. And so that was amazing. But to get to your question, Jonathan, I know this is a long way of getting to it.
Oh, I'm glad you took the long way.
Okay, cool. What I ended up finding was that at the age of 26 and a half years old, I ended up having my first quarter life crisis because I found myself in this chronic state of overwhelm of the amount of work that I'd created for myself. Because when I made that offer of being the most responsive salesperson, you know that those people took me up on that offer. I was getting 300 emails a day, phone calls, morning, noon, and night, nights and weekends. There was no boundary left untrampled. I found myself stuck in this place of, I can't change this because I'm making too much money, because I'm now hitting this trajectory where my company thinks I'm great. I've got this path as a young guy that I could do whatever I wanted. And there was all of this social agreement that this is what the job is, kid. I talked to salespeople that were two decades older than me, and they were like, hey, buddy, this is what you signed up for. As I stared into these bags under their eyes that have been accumulated of like nights and weekends and burnout over, you know, like 20 years of working this way. But fortunately, I came to that epiphany of this paradox of I had never been busier in my life, but I had never been lazier in my life. And how could you be busy and lazy at the same place in the same time? It sounds paradoxical, but I see this existing in many people. When you find yourself in a chronic state of busyness, it's getting worse. It's stressing you out. You want it to change, but you're not doing anything about it. That's lazy. It's just perpetual activity left uninspected. And so this is finally arriving at the meat of your question, Jonathan, which is, I had to look at the ecosystem that I'd created, and I found out that 18 months later, my most valuable asset was no longer me being the most responsive person. Actually, over the 18 months, I accumulated industry knowledge. Like, I was a killer presenter in finals presentations. I was someone that my clients came to for advice and guidance because I could see things they couldn't. So when I finally stopped and looked at my ecosystem, I was like, okay, now I need to go back and change and retrain my clients on how to engage with me. So over the next year, I had to actually let people know that here were the hours in which I was going to operate. It's between 8:30 and 5:30. And if there's like a DEFCON situation that you need me, and it's like absolutely, and I had to define that for them, then I was like, you can call me outside of those hours. Don't email me. Don't text me, because I'm not going to check that phone. Call me on this number. And guess what? Very few people ever did. And over the course of the next year, I was able to get my emails down to 75 emails per day. I was able to get back a sense of command in my life. And there were some eggs that were broken over that period of time where I had to have some difficult conversations with people and navigating them from what they were used to, because it was easier for them to just hot potato emails and messages to me. But once I navigated them through that change process, I ended up in a place where for the next decade of my life, I was hitting numbers, I was ascending in responsibility in the organization, and I had a life that incorporated balance where very few other of my peers had the same thing. And it was because I stopped, looked at that limiting habits and patterns and changed.
Let me go a little bit deeper on kind of that story that you told right there. I'm really curious, if you reflect back on your journey, and I would say that by almost any criteria, you are a unparalleled success in your field, in your profession, and that profession has kind of shifted over time. If you look back at your path to where you are now, would you say that that hustle and being willing to take all and be the most responsive person, was that the wrong way to do it? Or was that like a time in life and at some point you will and should pivot?
Love that question. I think it's kind of like startup mode. So the analogy I would give is if someone's starting up a business, the hustle and the grind is an inevitable part of that build up. Now, to what extent you sacrifice your own personal health and wellness is like a personal matter. I believe that at the foundational level, you should always be thinking about, am I building an ecosystem where either I'm the linchpin of that and everything funnels through me, and then if I step out, the whole thing collapses, or can I start to put systems in place where I am doing the hustle, I am working really hard, I am the most responsive, and I'm also constantly thinking about, how can I be building a system where like I can extract myself or move away as this thing starts to get wheels, or as I start to build a network in this industry? If you keep that as a conscious intention, then it allows you to smoothly transition much more effectively than if you go into it blindly. So Jonathan, I do believe that anytime you start something new, a new job, a new startup, a new side hustle, the hustle is going to be a bigger part of that, but you should always be looking for systems that scale, that allow you to step back as success grows.
Dom, I'm curious. We're always looking for actionable tips for the audience. Put yourself in the shoes of just one of our audience members, and they're listening to you. They're hearing this about habits and about drift. How would they today, like literally today, how would they take that step back and look at their lives and say, okay, I wasn't even aware of these negative habits until this moment, but where do I go from here? How do I find all those habits? People, like you're saying, this is unconscious. How does it become at the level where they can see it?
First place to start, ask yourself, where am I resentful? Or where do I feel like I'm obligated to do something constantly that I don't want to do? So let me get a little bit more specific around that. One of the big resentments I see specifically for, let's say, for working mothers would be that everything falls on their shoulders. For example, I'm expected to manage my career as if I don't have a family. I'm expected to manage my family as if I don't have a career. There's an absolute sense of pride in being able to do both, but there's this growing sense of resentment of there's never time for myself. For the man, it could be I'm constantly obligated to be a breadwinner, or if there's someone who's got raising a family and has aging parents and who's got breadwinner responsibilities at work, then there's no time for themselves. There's this growing sense of obligation around I am doing something for everyone else, but not for me. And I know I've given two family examples, but if like you can start to think about whatever life situation you're in, like as a single man, for me, that one of the resentments I had was I was finding that everyone would come to me to dump their emotional problems because I've built an entire life and a career around helping people remove their obstacles. But what I found was people would come to me to pick my brain, to suck out and extract my wisdom And it could be very emotional to hold space for people. And then they would just get what they needed and they would leave. And then I actually never found that I could go to anyone for this kind of stuff. And there was this growing resentment that I had a hard time expressing. And I felt obligated to always respond to someone's request because I would be a bad person if I said no to them, or if I said, hey, this is what I do for a living and that's what I charge for. And this is how I make my livelihood. And it's built up over decades of me investing money in myself and research and all that time and energy. So there is a value associated with that. Once I started to look at, why am I angry? Why am I upset? Why is this not fun? If you can go to those places where you are thematically consistently finding that you are resentful or acting in obligation, and you do a deeper inquiry around that, there's usually a story you are telling yourself. I have to do this because either I'm not a good person. I have to do this because if I don't, no one else will. I have to do this because, you know, my family depends on it and there's no one else. These are all limiting beliefs that if you are to say, offer up a different narrative, how else could this be done? Then there's an opportunity for you to step out of that obligation and resentment to actually establish a new pattern like I did with my clients. That allowed me to step into a place of greater command and liberation and freedom in my life.
Tom, that's awesome. So you're looking for these resentments, or I guess pain points might be another way of looking at it, just these areas of your life where things are not going well. How do you actually suggest that people do this on a granular level? Like, are they looking for individual points and then they do a deep dive? Do you suggest alternately that people just kind of view their lives for, let's say, days or a week or two and just jot down the pain points or resentments they're finding? How do you actually tell people to do this?
I love this idea. So let's just say, do an exercise. It could be 48 hours. It could be a week. If you could do a week, then you would have a much greater sample size. But let's just say I'm going to do an inventory on a daily basis around what I experience as a pain point or a resentment that frustrates me. Maybe I don't have enough money. I don't have as much freedom or time for me. I feel disempowered at work, whatever it is, and then jot that down as it happens, ideally, or, you know, do an inventory at the end of each day. At the end of the 48 hours, at the end of the week, revisit that list and look at what bubbles to the top. And as you're reading it, what is the most emotionally charged stuff that shows up? The thing that makes you feel viscerally the most upset is the place for you to go. And then once you go there, you start to ask my questions like, what are my underlying assumptions around why my life is this way? I constantly find that I don't have enough money. I want more money. Money is an issue in my household. I will never have enough money. Other people have more money than me and I'm upset at that. What you can start to do is like, what are my assumptions around money? Maybe money is evil, or I learned when I was a child that money was the root of all evil, or I learned that I don't have self-worth and I don't deserve money because I don't have a high opinion of myself. And are these things true? No, they're things that are operating in your blind spots. But once you get a chance to awaken to what's going on in that 95% of your thoughts and feelings and behaviors that are below your conscious detection, you can bring them above the surface and then inspect whether or not they have a place in your life.
So Dom, obviously we're talking about diving into the really impactful ones first, but I mean, people have many habits, right, that aren't serving them. And they might just be as simple as something around technology or something around, I don't know, some way they communicate with family members wouldn't rise to the level of what you're necessarily describing here, or at least how I'm hearing it. At what point do those items get tackled?
One of the biggest things that I see keeping people in a state of drift is technology, specifically our phones. Whether I'm talking to high performers, whether I'm talking to people who are farmers, whether I'm talking to people in Dubai, an emerging nation where when I was walking down the streets, construction workers on breaks, 100% of them are using their iPhones. Our technology is not just in adults' hands, it's in children's hands. It's a family issue. It's a productivity issue. It's in a personal mental health issue. One of the things that I've started to discover is that we've allowed this amazing technology into our lives without questioning what role we want it to play. Let me start with this caveat of, I am a huge proponent of technology. I'm usually one of the first people to buy the iPhone. I bought the Amazon Alexa before like any of my friends had it. So like, I love how it can connect us, FaceTiming with someone around the world, Skyping like what we're doing right now, podcasting. Like, technology is an essential part of our lives. However, most people do not realize how pervasive it is and the levels of stress that it causes and how it's keeping you from living a life of intentionality. So some statistics that may blow your mind around our cell phone use. Number one, 70% of business emails are opened within 6 seconds of it landing in your inbox. 70% of emails are opened within 6 seconds of landing in your inbox. That's staggering. 80% of people have experienced phantom phone vibration. And what that means, for those of you who, the 20% who don't know what I'm talking about, it's where you pull your phone out of your pocket or your purse because you could have sworn you heard it ring or buzz and actually nothing had happened. And among the teenage population, that's like, this is actually a phenomenon that's it's extraordinarily present. 91% of adults never allow their cell phone outside of an arm's length away from them. And you better believe technological manufacturers are trying to figure out a way to make that 100%. That's why the Apple Watch exists. Like, they want it on your body at all times. And the biggest statistic, this is the one that scares me the most. Some studies show that the average person unlocks their phone 110 times per day. If you only sleep 6 hours per night, which is way below the standard that you should be getting, and you're awake for 18 hours, you are unlocking your phone 5 to 6 times every waking hour of every day. Can you imagine what the cumulative effect that would be over weeks, months, years of your lifetime and your ability to remain present and focused and living without stress? It's having a profound effect on us. And what I learned in doing research around this is that Steve Jobs, when he invented the iPad, he would not allow his children to use it. Why? Because he knew the addictive nature of the technology that he was building, and he realized that certain protocols had to be put in place, especially for some of the younger minds. And that got me thinking about, if the biggest titan of technology of all time has a thoughtful process in place, what about us? And if we aren't ambassadors of our own technology and the way that we use it from a habitual standpoint, then who will be? And I'm sure we can get into a discussion about this, guys, but like, there's some really deep research that I've done that will, I think, scare some of your listeners in a useful way about how some of this technology is designed to keep you like legitimately addicted and how you can start to break those patterns so that you can step out of drift and actually have a conscious design around how you use your phones into the future.
Yeah. And you know, you said this term lazy busy, and it strikes me that it's incredible, all of the convenience that we have in the modern world. There's never been a better time to be alive. I mean, 2018, when we're recording this right now, every convenience you could possibly imagine is available to you. But what I find and what I see is that with all this time that we've been able to reclaim, a large percentage of the population is just putting that right back into Netflix, or, as you rightly pointed out, their cell phones, and kind of this lazy, busy mentality. So at the same time, we, at the height of arrogance, we say, we have no time, we're so busy. But if you were to actually track that time, it's going into these drift-like habits. It's something that, you know, as a podcaster and as someone that obviously that heavily leverages technology and leans on it and benefits from it, you know, I struggle with personally to find that point of diminishing returns and set those boundaries for myself, for my wife, for my son.
Yeah, and lazy busy certainly hit home to me as well, Dom. I think in my more introspective moments, it's hard for me, because I think on like a macro level, my life is going wonderfully. Things are great financially. I think I'm making a positive impact on the world with this podcast. And yet I'm not sure that I'm anywhere near intentional enough with my days or weeks or even months. I don't have plans. I just kind of drift through. And at the end of a day, I'm not sure that I ever had an intention, right? Or one big goal. Hey, what would make this a successful day? And like, it's funny, because I know that this stuff is important. I've researched it. I've listened to you talk about it. I've read books, but yet it still doesn't necessarily happen. And I don't know what I need to do to get over that hump. And I'd love if you had any thoughts on that.
Yeah. So Brad, I'm going to go with you first here. So one of the things that Napoleon Hill talks about with the antidote to drift is to having an overarching mission or purpose that is so inspiring to you that like when you are about to exit this earth, that like the legacy that you've left behind is something that's so powerful that you feel like you've lived a life of intentionality. And you may remember that one of the exercises I recommend in my book that we talked about on your last podcast is writing your eulogy. And I know that some people can kind of bristle at that because like the idea of contemplating death is something that's scary. It's actually a beautiful moment to be able to connect with, not the act of death, but to connect with this, like I've lived 80, 90, 100, 120 years, whatever you think. And like, what did all of these great days look like in front of you? Because if you have this North Star, if you have this like GPS destination that you're going, then when drift kicks in like these moments of a daily day in and day out grind, you can actually course correct very quickly. The analogy I think many people have heard is when a pilot takes off and they're heading towards a destination, they're off track 95% of the time. But as long as they understand the flight pattern of the destination they're going, all they need to do is stick that landing, and that's a successful mission. So I offer people the chance to think about like, how long do you want to live? Who are the lives that you touched? What is the legacy you live behind? If the greatest days of your life were in front of you, what would those look like? You know, and how did those unfold for you? And for you, Brad, specifically, it's like you have this platform where you have millions of downloads on this podcast. If you are affecting lives of not just your listeners, but their families, could there be 10 million people who are living a FI lifestyle by the time that you've, you know, finished your time here on earth? And what would that mean for them? How many people will have been pulled out of poverty? How many people will be contributing back to their society? What is the reverberating effect of that in the world based on like what you and Jonathan are doing right now? And when you can really connect to that on a conscious and consistent basis, then when like some of these daily things pop up that seem trivial that could pull you off path, that mission can come back and center you and say, I'm doing this because that's so important to me.
And here's the line that I continue to grapple with. What if that mission in and of itself becomes addicting? And you're talking, this all has to happen in the context of balance. That mission is incredible. How does family fit into this? And what about when that mission has a technology component to it to be able to tether that to the point where if you're talking about taking a day off or going on a trip with your family, you kind of have this fear that you don't want to leave it. You're not sure if it's going to be there or it's going to be okay when you get back. And those are subtle guilt trips, but at the same time, they feed into this desire to be lazy busy.
Yeah. And okay, so let's get really specific then maybe about technology, because this is the thing that even if you have an overarching purpose can still get in the way of you living a life of intentionality. So let me give you a prime example of someone who lives a life of intentionality. You've had him as a guest on your podcast. His name is Corey Mascara. Corey is a great friend of mine. Corey is a mindfulness instructor. His purpose in life is to awaken and enlighten people to becoming present through the art of mindfulness. And he's going to help millions of people before his time here is done. And he's already helping thousands and tens of thousands of people to do that. Corey spent 6 months in Burma in complete silence. Didn't speak to anyone, didn't talk to anyone for 18 hours and sometimes up to 22 hours per day of just meditating, making no eye contact with anyone. This is a person who is an expert in the art of presence. As he's come back into the Western world and he's developed a business that now requires being on Facebook, that requires being on Instagram, that he has to market on an email list. So he's constantly leveraging technology to get his message out. Corey can find himself in a place of drift because the forces of technology are so powerful. And so he regularly does these technology detoxes where sometimes he'll go off social media for a week, a month, et cetera, turn off his notifications so that he can say, where did I find this seeping into the most important parts of my life? Like with his relationship with his girlfriend, did he find himself not being able to connect with her because he was worried about the thing that flashed in his, or that vibrated in his pocket, and wondering, like, there's this ticking clock in his head where, is she going to stop talking so I can go to the bathroom and check the thing that may be blowing up or detonating in my pocket right now? And so many of us can relate to that. So the place that I constantly ask people to start is to say, define what role technology is supposed to play in your life. And is technology helping advance that cause, or is it actually sabotaging that cause? I find that most people haven't even asked that question. That's when, Jonathan, it starts to pull you off your path, because we haven't really even defined what we want it to serve in our lives.
Dominic, anecdotally, I can say that this absolutely reflects something that I struggle with in my personal life. And I suspect also anecdotally that there are tens of thousands of other, if not millions of other people that are grappling with this dilemma as well. I'm curious, like, is this backed up by data at this point? Are there any studies that have been done to actually analyze how pervasive this problem really is?
Absolutely. Okay. So there's an unbelievable book that I read called Irresistible: The Rise of Addictive Technology and the Business of Keeping Us Hooked. And it's by Adam Alter, who's a professor at NYU. And a lot of the statistics that I'm about to share with you, I downloaded from that book. Inside the book, there's stories about a gentleman by the name of Tristan Harris. Tristan Harris is now the founder of something called the Center for Humane Technology. But his origins was that he was a developer or a coder for Google. He was extremely talented, but the work that he was doing behind the scenes in Silicon Valley, he was finding that technologists were designing technology not to enhance your lives, but to keep you addicted to the technology. So think about this. When an app developer is developing an app and they want to get funding for their app from venture capitalists at a certain point in time, what venture capitalists, what money and seed money is looking for is, how many times is a person going in and opening that app, and are they spending more and more time on that app? And so it's all about how much they can keep you hooked on that technology, not is it enhancing your life. And I don't think there's some grand conspiracy or an evil empire that's looking to keep us as zombies in our technology. It's just how this system is set up, the reward system, the incentive system for people to design technology this way, that when you download one app that's designed that way and you have 20 apps like that on your phone and you have a phone that's specifically engineered to keep you hooked, this collective effort and energy, it's no wonder why we spend our time on our phone. Tristan Harris said that there are 1,000 of the best and brightest designers on the other side of your screen working very hard to break down your sense of self-regulation. 1,000 of the best and brightest designers working very hard to break down your sense of self-regulation. And guess what? They're succeeding. What those designers are doing is, this is true, they are going to the original gangsters of how to keep us hooked. They're going to the slot machine manufacturers that figured out how to get a fully functioning adult to sit in front of a slot machine in a chair for 15 hours with flashing lights, pulling a lever, wearing an adult diaper, not moving, so that they could just have that dopamine hit of getting a reward that is unpredictable. And by the way, there's this concept that Tristan talks about of variable rewards. We as humans are highly addictive to this concept of receiving a variable reward, meaning when we don't know a payoff is going to occur. And that's what a slot machine is, right? Like, you can sit there pulling, there's no rhyme or reason. The win occurs when it occurs, and then your body floods with dopamine when it happens. That's why a lot of people in relationships, like if you've ever thought about going after someone who you know is not good for you, who you probably don't even like that much, but because they're so inconsistent with their affection, when they finally show that you that attention, that variable reward, your body floods with chemicals and you're like, ooh, I need more of that. The way that the Facebooks of the world have implemented these subtle little triggers, next time you go on your Facebook app, watch for this. Facebook, when you pull it up in that notification tab, that little world icon, it used to, as soon as you signed on, it used to show you exactly how many notifications you had. Now, they skip a beat. There's like a second long pause or a 2 second long pause where there's no notification. And you're left in this place of, ooh, I've got no notifications. I must suck. So it holds it back and then it releases that notification so that you go, oh my God, thank goodness I'm not irrelevant. Let's see what those are. And then you go dive in and then there's more chemicals that are flooding your body.
I wonder how many people are taking their phones out right now to check and see if that is actually happening.
Watch it. It happened. And I think Twitter does it too, from what Tristan Harris said, like these extremely manipulative things that are keeping us hooked. And this last example that I want to give you that I saw in 60 Minutes, Anderson Cooper went on 60 Minutes. He went to a biometric facility where they hooked him up to all these sensors. They took his phone away from him. They placed it just far enough away from him so that he couldn't like grab at it. And all they did was have him watch his phone as his notifications popped up. And as the notifications popped up, he just observed it. And they would ask him a question, say, Anderson, what are you feeling as these notifications are flashing? He goes, I'm feeling nothing. Like my phone flashes notifications all day long. I'm used to this. But the machines that were monitoring what was going on internally told an entirely different story. Every time a notification flashed, his entire body flooded with cortisol. Cortisol is the stress hormone. Cortisol is the thing that stresses you out. It's something that can actually spur you into action. It's something that requires urgency and attention right now. And it falls below his conscious detection. Brad, Jonathan, think of how many times your phone buzzes, flashes, pings, rings. It is triggering that cortisol release in your system that is calling you into action. Even though on a conscious level you think you're overriding that, it is sending your unconscious system, which is responsible for 95% of what you think, feel, and do, to say, I need to go there. And so you are constantly in this state of tug of war. And what we found in talking to neuroscientists that I've done work with on this is that it puts you in this constant state of survivalism. And when you're in this constant state of survival, you're in fight or flight mode, you think that everything is urgent and critical. And it's not. And that's why people have such a hard time where they think that they can never take a vacation because it's like an email is life or death. No, you've just trained your body and your system and your chemistry to feeling that way. So when you create these temporary breaks, and I'll share with you some very specific tactical ways that you can break this pattern, this chronic state of being in stress, that you can start to take back command of what role technology is playing in your life and how it can serve you, not sabotage and hijack your day.
That's absolutely frightening that our bodies are just reacting on this physiological level that we're just unaware of. Are we just so used to this? And we just simply tune it out. We don't detect these cortisol spikes. Do you think if you, at the very beginning, the first couple of times you would have noticed you were in an anxious state, like the very first, you know, couple of days you had a phone, or is it we just simply don't detect this? Like, is it too little, or what do these spikes look like on a real basis?
So I can't answer it specifically from a science perspective, but what I can tell you from a lived perspective, from my own personal experience and also with a lot of my clients, it's a subtle and gradual layering on, kind of like you don't just wake up overnight 20 pounds heavier. When you put on weight, it's something that happens gradually and almost you don't recognize it until you see that picture of you 3 months earlier and you're like, oh my God, I'm a stranger to myself. And I think we only step up and I think actually a lot of people don't ever realize how chronic it's gotten. But when people have had that awareness of, holy cow, this is something that I think is problematic. I think the biggest problem, Brad, is that most people, A, don't know what to do about it. B, there's so much social approval around how addicted we are to our phones. And we kind of laugh it off that we don't actually see it for the problem that it is. And in that book that I recommended, Irresistible by Adam Alter, there are addiction treatment facilities that already exist today in the United States for people who are addicted to gaming. Actually, I believe there was something I saw, an announcement in the news. They're like the World Health Organization or the Human Health Organization has now recognized gaming as being a national epidemic because it is so addictive. And technological manufacturers, gaming manufacturers, test kids in facilities to see how they're responding to the game, that if their blood pressure does not spike to a certain level that actually reaches upon what people experience when they're on cocaine, they will go back and tweak the game until it reaches that level because that's the optimal state where a person will play a game for 12 hours. There are treatment facilities for addiction to your cell phone as well. I'm getting so fired up around these statistics, Brad, and I'm losing sight of the original question that you asked, which I believe really around, do we know when it's happening to us? I think the answer is, I think we're starting to get a sense of it, but I don't think we are treating it with the kind of urgency that we need to, and it's becoming a growing epidemic.
Yeah, and I wonder, and I'd love to hear about like specific tactics, because I've done some of these things. So I've shut off notifications mostly, so I have to actually open the phone, and then like there's this level of friction, let's say. The notifications cut through and just make it frictionless because you see it automatically. But I feel anytime you have to take that extra step or two, that it's a little bit more difficult. And I want to be perfectly candid here. My, just in recording this podcast, and it's funny, Dom, because even just hearing you talk about this and trying to become more aware of these unconscious habits, it's amazing how you can see them. So perfect example is when I'm recording, I have a stand-up desk. All right, so I'm standing here talking right now, but there are a couple times during the hour that we record that I just sit down because my bed's pretty close and my phone is sitting right there. Literally every time I sat down, I looked at my phone. It was only 15 seconds each time, maybe less, because obviously I'm listening to you and Jonathan, clearly, but I checked my damn phone while we're talking about this. How pathetic is that?
You are so pathetic. I'm so embarrassed for you. No, I'm just kidding. I'm sure I did too.
I'm sure you checked it 30 times in the lens.
I was so much better. I used the desktop web app.
Nice. But you know, Tom, isn't that amazing? I try to set up systems, but yet it's something like that I just wouldn't have even noticed. Why is my phone right here at the foot of the bed as opposed to 10 feet away where there's no possibility, just because I'm tethered in here to my computer, there's no possibility then that I couldn't check it. Isn't that amazing?
It is and it isn't. So the first thing, Brad, and I know you're being totally tongue-in-cheek about this, but the first thing that we have to do as we approach our technological habits is to give ourselves a break. Like I know you said, isn't that pathetic? The answer is no. Absolutely not, because the way that our technology is designed is so intricately and wisely and brilliantly designed to have you do exactly what it is that you did. And it's playing to your neurochemistry. It's playing to the most like ancient reactive emotional parts of who you are. So quite frankly, it's not pathetic at all, Brad. It demonstrates that you're a human being, and it also demonstrates that there's more that can be done. So for anyone who's looking at approaching this, if you shame yourself around this, it's going to be a much harder road to toe. I think the first entry point is just realizing, wow, I'm up against a pretty big force here. I want to be light around this. I want to be playful around it. And I also need to understand, and here's the thing that I've understood in 2 years of really diving deep on this, is that there is no silver bullet, that once you do like this one thing or these three things, that you will be on autopilot forever. You are constantly going to have to, like, you are going to be drifting, and you're constantly going to have to revisit this stuff on a regular basis because the forces are so strong. And that's why Corey Mascara, 6 months in silent meditation, a presence expert, has to take his own detoxes. So give yourself a break first. Now, here's the first step that I took, and I encourage everyone else to take. I mentioned this on the hot seat last time we talked, which was the first place you need to go is to calibrate how much time are you actually spending on your phone today. You need a baseline. If you have an iPhone, the technology that you want to download, and this is one that actually enhances your life, is called the Moment app. If you have an Android, I believe it's called Quality Time. What these apps do, they do three things. Number one, it tells you how many times a day you unlock your phone. Remember I said the average person about 110 times a day? You want to calibrate how many times a day you unlock your phone. Number two, it tells you how much screen time you spend. So it's not how much time you spend on calls, but how much time you're actually looking down at the screen, emails, text messages, social media. And I believe it breaks it down into like how much time you're spending on each of those apps. So like you could see where your problem childs are. By the way, the designer of this app said that most people underestimate how much screen time they spend. By 50%, I was one of those people. And the third thing it teaches you is it timestamps all of your log-ons. So it shows you, I logged on at 7:15 this morning and I spent 30 minutes on it. Or I spent, 2 minutes here, 17 minutes there. which helps you to start to identify your problem times for the day. What I found when I downloaded this and what I did was I let the experiment run for a week. So here's what I encourage your listeners to do. Download the Moment app. Don't change any of your behaviors. Run it for a week. And what it will do is it will let you know. Here's what it let me know. I was spending 4.5 hours per day on my screen. 4.5 hours looking down on my phone. My big problem areas were my morning and my evening, because the first thing I did when I woke up in the morning, pulled out my phone, 45 minutes. End of the day when I'm exhausted and I'm sitting on my couch or lying in my bed, it was an hour just going down the rabbit hole of the scroll on my social media. And so I found that the most important times of my day, the bookends of my day that determine what happens in the 16 hours between, were lost to me being in a completely reactive, zoned out state of being in my phone. So what I would say is, I don't know how much time you should be spending on your phone. I just know it should be less. And when I started to calibrate from this place, some of the other stuff I'll share with you in a second, and I'll pause, like other techniques I used, I was able to take down my usage of my phone from 4.5 hours down to 2 hours and 15 minutes a day. And in the first 90 days that I did that, I ended up having over 180 hours of excess time, which I dedicated to writing my book, Design Your Future. I wrote a book in a 90-day period of time, because when you have that much time back, it's magic. And what would you do with your time if you were to get an hour, half an hour, 2 hours back over a 90-day period? Like, you could literally change your life like writing my book did for me.
So Dom, obviously the time is essential. I totally get that. But you also described this cortisol rush of seeing these notifications or just knowing they're there, right? Or checking the phone. How do you cut down on the number of times you actually check the phone? Is it shutting it off? Is it keeping it out of proximity? Like, are there ways to mitigate that cortisol rush that just keeps happening over and over that we're just not aware of?
Brilliant question. And by the way, the bookend to your question about the cortisol rush, like when you're stressed out, you seek a reward. And when you seek a reward to placate you, it could come in the form of looking for notifications on Facebook, or did someone like your thing, or did you get that email from the person you were waiting for? Can you see how the cycle perpetuates itself? The very thing that provides the tonic, the elixir, is the thing that provides the pain. So you end up in this chronic state of just going down that rabbit hole. So the two things that I would recommend is, number one, I found that when I asked this question in audiences, that 90% of people use their cell phone as their alarm clock. And when you use your cell phone as your alarm clock, you're almost guaranteed that in the first 15 to 20 minutes of your day, you're looking at your phone, and it's the last 15 to 20 minutes of your day is looking at your phone. The first thing that I encourage everyone to do, that's what I did. That's why I had an hour and 45 minutes of my beginning and ending of my day was locked up in my phone. Take your phone out of your room, go old school, buy an alarm clock. If you don't think the government is listening to you and you're okay with having an Amazon Alexa in your room, have a voice activated device that will wake you up in the morning. That's what I use. Get your phone out of your room. That will immediately cut down somewhere between a half an hour to an hour of use per day. It will actually help you to sleep better and also start your day more intentionally. And the second thing, this is huge. This is about notifications. Your phone, when you accumulate apps and downloads, et cetera, like almost all of them are automatically set up to notify you. And I see so many different layers of notifications. Like, if your phone is just sitting in front of you, people have notifications where like their phone flashes. They have notifications where something will pop up on the locked screen. When you're on your screen, there's these drop-down notifications. There's buzzing, vibrating notifications. There's the little red dots on the icons. All of those contribute to like the cortisol thing that you're talking about, Brad. And how many of those things are actually essential? So what I've taught all my clients is eliminate all non-essential notifications. I'm going to go to the extreme where I am right now, and then I'll dial it back. I only have two notifications, period. Number one, my phone calls. So I have my phone calls come through, obviously, because if people want to reach me, and I've trained people to know that if they need to reach me, that's the way to get me in a time-sensitive fashion. And number two, my flight app for Delta, because I fly a lot. If there's flight changes, I need to know about it. That's something that's essential and timely. I have my notifications turned off for email, for text message, for voicemails. I have learned to go in and check every 45 minutes or hour or whatever. And by the way, because people have been trained on how to engage with me, if there's something urgent, they know to call. And so the things that maybe I missed out on, like early on when I transitioned to no notifications on email and text messages, yeah, there were some eggs that were broken or some things that I missed that I could have gotten in a timelier fashion. But those short-term pain points have vastly been overweighed by this ecosystem I now create, this freedom of not having to look or not being pulled out of my moment because there's something buzzing, ringing, flashing, or pinging.
Yeah, Dom, it's just such powerful information. And I'm curious, do you personally turn your phone off at any point during the day or keep it away from you? What does your perfect day look like, maybe with technology or just generally speaking?
Okay, cool. I'll answer the question about the phone. Do I turn it off? Absolutely. A big part of my work is to do deep thinking. Anytime I have to do something deep or strategic, phone's got to go off. My iPad, my laptop needs to go away because all of the most creative thoughts come after like 15, 20 minutes of maybe sometimes dealing with frustration, coming up against dead ends. It's when you break through that like the epiphanies occur. And I haven't read the book, but I've heard enough people talk about it and share stories with me about, it's called Deep Work by Cal Newport. And what Cal Newport talks about is like, you have to create these environments where you don't have interruptions, because if you're thinking about something, if you're working on something strategic, it could be work related or could it be relationship oriented. If something pulls you out of it, like a phone call or an email or a notification, then it automatically shifts your attention and it takes like cognitive power to move over there. And there's this like cognitive residue that even when you take your conscious mindset back to whatever you were working on, this cognitive residue is still attached to that interruption. So your phone needs to actually not just be turned off, but Brad, to the point that you made before, needs to be out of your eyesight. Because as soon as you see it, you're going to be like, oh, I wonder what, you know, is on Facebook, or I wonder what email or whatever. If you take it out of your sight, then it's one of the best things for you to be able to do the deeper thinking and without interruption. So the other question you asked about, what does like an optimal day look like? One of the things that like stunned me, even when I looked at the most highest of performers, these are people, men and women who are like running businesses for Fortune 500 companies. When I did an inventory of their days, I found that they had absolutely no plan for the first hour of their day and for the last hour of their day. And the bookends of the day are what, like I said before, are what determines the success of what happens in the 15, 16, 17 waking hours in between. The most common way that I saw a person opening up the first hour was they would shoot out of bed and like the fire hose would be turned on. So they'd be immediately into their phone, reacting to all the stuff that piled up over the night before, kids running around or screaming in the house, like getting them navigated out through the door. And then they would like race to work, where it would just be another constant barrage of meetings. And then at the end of the day, they'd be exhausted. And the last hour of the day would be kind of like disappearing into oblivion. So either just like scrolling on social media mindlessly or Netflixing themselves to death. And then they wake up, rinse and repeat. And it was no wonder that I was finding people who are living very successful lives that most people would aspire to have from the outside looking in. But it was truly like one day was bleeding into the next. And they would wake up 5 years later and be like, oh my God, all those things I said I wanted to do 5 years ago, none of them have been done. I'm doing the same things that I said I would stop doing. Here's something that I encourage people to think about for the first hour and last hour of their day. And by the way, if your lifestyle does not allow for a full hour right now, think about this as the first 15 minutes of your day and last 15 minutes of your day, and you can build up to an hour once you see how powerful this is. The first hour of my day is all about state. And when I say state, it's what state do I want to be in as I attack the next 15 hours of my day? For example, when I wake up on a day where I'm giving a keynote speech in front of 500 people, I want my state to be energized, present, and from a service mindset. What I mean by that is I don't want to be consumed with fears of how I look, can I be a hero when I'm on stage? But actually coming from a standpoint of the audience, what are these people, what are these people's problems? What are they coming to hear about? And how could I move them to higher ground? So I define my state that I want to feel for that day. And then it's like, what are the activities that contribute to that state of being energized, of being present, and of being of a service mindset? And for me, to be energized, like one of the things I have to do is I have to have some form of movement in the morning. It could be like 10 minutes of just exercise, running, push-ups, jumping jacks, followed by a cold shower. Like that will wake you up like nobody's business. Presence for me is all about eating the right thing and potentially either reading a text that gets me present, like something like a mindfulness book or spiritual book, or meditating. And that's how I design my first hour. And I have like a pretty specific protocol for speaking days. I also have a specific protocol for normal days where I wake up at home and, you know, it's just about working. If you would like a recommendation on like some ideas that you could do, there's a great book called Miracle Morning by Hal Elrod. And he has six different techniques that you can unpack about like how you could create an optimal state for your morning. And I'll pause there before I go into like what I believe your evening hour to be about. But does that resonate with you guys? And do you have any questions on that?
Yeah, I would say that I do find that I am guilty of both of those. So my son comes into my, you know, bedroom first thing in the morning, and my wife goes downstairs to make coffee. And while my son is potentially just hanging out with me, you know, in the bedroom, my phone is in my hand and I'm just kind of going through my morning process. And then at night, that last hour of the night, I can absolutely identify the drift at what you're talking about and how that does just bleed into the next day. I find that I get a lot done during the day, but my routine is garbage on both ends of that equation.
I feel you. And one of the things that, so my routine was garbage for a while too. The reason why I know a lot of this stuff is because I've struggled with a lot of this stuff. So if you find yourself listening to this and you're beating yourself up, let that go. That's like making yourself wrong or having negative self-talk around. It detracts from your energy. And just know that the people who are the best at this stuff are the ones that have struggled with it the most. And that's why we had to find a solution for it. And for me, I have a compulsive personality. So I get swept up into things that I enjoy. And technology for me, one thing I had to make a commitment on was that I was not going to look at my phone for the first half hour of waking. So if I wake up at 6 a.m., I'm not going to be picking up my phone until 6:30 or after. And that has served me so well because in that minimum first 30 minutes of the day, I can really reflect on like, what are the three things that I need to do today that if I were to do them, that this day would be an absolute success? And could I get them done before noontime? Because after that, then the entire day is gravy. And by the way, most times you can get those things done before noon and then everything else is great. You just have to prioritize them and not allow for things to sabotage you and keep you in drift.
Yeah, not checking the phone. I mean, that even though I have gotten dramatically better at this, so I leave my phone in airplane mode and I find that that helps significantly as far as not obviously checking emails or texts or whatever, because they're just simply not coming through. So I think I'm okay there. But where I get into trouble is listening to podcasts. And actually, Dom, we talked about this offline, and I've done dramatically better in that I've probably cut my subscriptions to 80% of my podcasts at this point, because it was just this point of overwhelm where I was just constantly stressed because I had this backlog of podcasts. I needed to listen to them because new ones were coming out. I think I've done better there, but I still listen to the remaining ones. And that's kind of the first thing I do in the morning. And then it's, oh, my bed is comfortable. I'm lying here. I would love to get out and do yoga or stretching, which is probably like my optimal morning routine, but it's inconvenient with the stupid headphones, right? So like I've built this script. I'd feel so much better the entire day if I did that yoga or stretching. Sometimes I just still lie there with these dopey headphones that are tethering me to this podcast. I think that awareness, I'm really going to try that. Don't even pick it up. Don't pick up the phone for 30 minutes. Get out of bed and do that. And I suspect that's going to be a much better and healthier day.
Well, tying this all together, again, if you can go back to, if you get really present to what you want to leave behind when your time here on earth is done. What is this big work that you're doing? And you can keep that as a part of your consciousness every day on some level, right? Even if like you were to write a note to yourself, it's on your bathroom mirror, whatever it is. So it's like a part of your daily existence system. Then you will remember that the first hour of my day is all about managing optimal state. So my optimal state can help me contribute to the work that I'm doing that gets me towards that North Star of this place, this legacy that I want to leave behind, these people that I have impacted. And when you find yourself in that place of, hey, does listening to this podcast contribute to my optimal state for the next 15 hours of the day? Sometimes it might, because sometimes you may be just like so burned out and you don't need to get out of bed. And maybe that podcast is exactly what you need. But most days, it's probably just about being lazy and doing something that's just like, you don't have to do anything active like yoga would require you to do. Then you can know it's like, man, I'm going to get up out of bed because what this day requires, what my lifetime requires, like what this big work requires, is for me to get up and be in action that promotes this optimal state. And so let's move to the final hour of the day, because this will help you start off your day with much more success. The last hour of the day, most people, like I said, just kind of go into oblivion, pass out with the TV on, scroll until you can't keep your eyes open. And then like, you know, you just wake up in the morning. The last hour of the day for me is about reflection of the day that I just had and intention setting for the day ahead. And this actually doesn't need to take a full hour. Like you could do this in 5 minutes. You could do this in 15 minutes. For me, when it's like really rocking, you know, like, well, actually, let me just do like a 15-minute version of that. A reflection on the day that I just had would include a gratitude list. So I would have a notebook where I would reflect on like chronologically from the moment I woke up going throughout the course of the events over the day. And it's funny, like sometimes you don't realize how much you do over the course of the day until you actually scan through it, almost like you scan your body from bottom to top or top to bottom, how much there was that went down. And I write down the things I was grateful for, the interactions with people that I had, what I accomplished, some of the pain that I felt. I might even like write that down to just be like, I made it through it. And that's the reflection on the day. And then it's like, okay, what's tomorrow about? And I look at my calendar. A lot of people don't even look at their calendar for the next day. They don't even know what's there until like they jump out of bed in the morning. It's like, oh my God, here's what today is about. I look at what is the intention I want to set for tomorrow? And how am I going to wake up when the alarm goes off? And Brad, if like you start to do that on a much more regular basis, I can guarantee you that when you wake up, you're going to know, is today the podcast day or is today the yoga day? And it'll be much easier in many cases. And here's the place you really want to get to. This is the amazing part, is you want to eliminate the decision altogether. The more decisions you have to make, the more cognitive load you are asking yourself to carry, you will be exhausted. And when you find yourself in that moment where your willpower and discipline is down, you will take the path of least resistance, which is oftentimes drift. If you make the decision the night before to say, tomorrow I'm getting up and I'm doing yoga, and it's not even a question when you wake up, even if you don't feel like it, it actually won't feel that hard. You'll get up and do it.
Dominic, this has been intense. And I mean that in the absolute best sense of the word. This podcast was exactly what I needed today. And I think it will be for so many of our listeners. Now, we have been huge fans of your book, Design Your Future, and we talk about it virtually on every other episode. We have set up a short code where people can find the book, chooseify.com/design. I highly encourage everyone to go give that a read. It will be a valuable use of your intentional time. But Dominic, for you today, what is the best way for someone to connect with you?
Awesome. By the way, I'm sending Brad 5 copies of the book so you guys can give them away to some of your listeners, and you can choose to do that however you see fit. My Instagram is where I tend to be posting a lot of what I'm doing personally, professionally, talking about a lot of this stuff. So that's at Dominic Q. And you guys, I'm sure, will put that in the show notes for spelling. And my website, DominicQ.com, also has a place you can sign up for a newsletter that I put out on a weekly basis.
Dominic, thank you so much for coming on the show. This has been a blast.
Fellas, always a pleasure, man. Talk to you soon.
You know, Brad, there's episodes that you finish and you are exhausted, but in the best way possible. Like, this is something that you needed to hear. This spoke to your soul. And you know, if you take action on it, your life will be better. That was this episode.
Yeah, you're right. It's when it really hits home. I think it's just impactful. I think both of us feel that right now. I am kind of drained, but in a good way. Obviously Dom is such an energizing person, but there are these areas of my life that I just want to improve. And like Dom kind of said in there, I don't need to beat myself down and say, oh, that's pathetic. If I view this as a very positive thing, then I think good, happy changes will come out of it. And I think that's the takeaway for me with Dom's message and the episode today is that, all right, you need to take a step back, realize where your habits are and aren't serving you, and make the changes that you need, and make them because it's going to make a better life for you. And I think that's a really wonderful message.
All right, my friends, if you got value from this episode, more so than any episode, you know, take a second today and share it with someone else that you think might enjoy listening. But even more than that, take 1 second, press the subscribe button on the platform you're listening to this on. It just lets the providers know you're getting value from the show and you want to be here when we produce additional content. If you want to support us and what we're doing here at Choose FI, here are 4 easy ways. 1, leave us an iTunes review. If you want to do that, just go to choosefi.com/iTunes. 2, use our page to sign up for travel credit cards. If you want to travel the world with miles and points instead of your hard-earned dollars, then just go to choosefi.com/cards and get started today. 3, if you're working on the milestones of FI, set up a personal capital account to track your progress and use our affiliate link. It's completely free and just go to choosefi.com/PC. P as in Paul, C as in cat. And 4, and most importantly, find your friends, coworkers, and family members who might be open to this message and tell them about the podcast. Have them start with episode 38, The Why of FI, and right behind that, have them go listen to episode 21, The Pillars of FI. It is a fantastic starting place. All right, my friends, the fire is spreading. We'll see you next time as we continue to go down the road less traveled.
You've been listening to Choose FI Radio Podcast, where we help middle-class America build wealth, one life hack at a time.